Well, we welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. We have three cases for oral argument. We have one set on the 9 o'clock docket and two cases set on the 10:30 docket. So we will recess between or after the first case for a short break. The first case on our docket is Dalworth Restoration versus Angie Rife Marshall. If the clerk will please announce counsel who will be arguing today. Thank you, gentlemen. All right, Mr. Yanoff, if you're ready to proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Mike Yanoff and I represent the appellant, Dalworth Restoration. This case is about enforcement of a mandatory statutory provision. There are three undisputed facts that are important for the issue presented, each of which occurred before the judgment was entered by the trial court. First, the defendant below, the remaining defendant, asked the trial court for a settlement credit under Civil Practice and Remedies Code Section 33.012. Second, there was undisputed evidence of a settlement between plaintiff and a settling person and undisputed evidence of the settlement amount in the record before the trial court. And third, the plaintiff did not enter the settlement agreement into evidence before the trial court. The issue is simple. Did the trial court abuse its discretion in not applying the 33.012 settlement credit given these undisputed facts? Every Texas court to answer the question under that scenario has held that it was an abuse of discretion and has reversed and rendered judgment. There are no exceptions in Texas under this scenario. The reasons are simple. First, Section 33.012 is mandatory. It is not a discretionary statute. It is not permissive. It uses the word shall. It is mandatory. Second, all the defendants had to do under the burden-shifting analysis set forth by the Supreme Court in Mobil Oil Corp. versus Ellender and many cases after that, under the burden-shifting, all the defendant had to do is put on evidence that there was, in fact, a settlement and of the settlement amount. And once the defendant did that, the burden shifted to the plaintiff to refute that evidence. And the failure to refute that evidence means the settlement credit in full had to apply. And the only way that could be refuted was by putting the settlement agreement into evidence before the court. Case law is clear that no extrinsic evidence could be provided by the plaintiff. Case law is also clear that it was the plaintiff's burden to do so.
Well, but, I was going to ask you about the burden and burden shifting. Could you run through that real quick and exactly what, for example, elements or facts are covered by the first part of the burden shifting?
Sure.
Analysis. Would that only include the amount of a settlement that you know about and the what?
Sure.
Name of the defendant. What about whether the settling defendant was a joint and several tortfeasor, for example?
Sure. The burden starts with the defendant. And the case law is clear that under this version of the statute, that there used to be a version that required a written election, but the legislature has written that out of the statute. The defendant has to ask the trial court for a settlement credit, verbally, in writing, somehow, make it clear to the court that it wanted a settlement credit. And that's not at issue here. That clearly was before the court. So you have to ask for one as a defendant. Second, you have to put evidence into the record before the trial court. And the case law is clear. Utz versus Short, the Supreme Court case, said you don't put it into evidence before the jury. You put it before the trial court. Evidence that a settlement has occurred between the plaintiff and some third party. Now, in this case, it was clearly a settling person because Liberty Mutual was submitted to the jury as a settling person. But that's not a requirement. That just happens to be what was the case here. So second, that a settlement has occurred. And third, you have to put on evidence of any kind, stipulated evidence, something in writing, some type of evidence. It can be affidavit, testimony, whatever the case may be. Here it was stipulated, of the amount of the settlement, period. That is the defendant's burden to get the settlement credit. Now, how much of that credit the defendant gets is where the burden shifts, because at that point, the defendant has satisfied its burden to be entitled to the full amount of the settlement credit. And at that moment, the burden shifts to the defendant, to the plaintiff. The plaintiff is the only one who can refute and keep the entire settlement amount from being applied to the judgment, if there is going to be a judgment. The burden shifts at that point. And only the plaintiff at that point, the plaintiff can refute the settlement amount and say, some of it's related to this case, some of it isn't. Some of it's related to actual damages, some of it's related to punitive damages. But there's only one way the plaintiff can do that. And Mobil Oil Corp versus Ellender held this, Supreme Court. The one way is to put the settlement agreement into evidence before the trial court. And if the plaintiff chooses not to do that, then the entire amount must be applied to the settlement. To the judgment.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's okay.
Well, doesn't this statute speak to the problem of a party getting more than one, a plaintiff getting more than one satisfaction for damages for the same injury? And doesn't, who has the burden under your analysis to prove, to show that it's, that the amount of the settlement is damages for the same injury that the jury found your client?
But it's not a windfall in essence.
Right. One satisfaction rule.
The burden is on the plaintiff to show that. The defendant has one burden, to show that there was a settlement with a third party and what the amount was. It is the plaintiff's burden to delineate those damages to show whether they're related or unrelated. And the reason the Supreme Court has said that is because the plaintiff is in the unique position of having settled with a third party. The defendant does not have the benefit of that settlement agreement necessarily. And in fact, what's clear in this record was that the defendant did not have the benefit of that settlement agreement, and that the plaintiff had not provided it to defendant, not casting aspersions. The plaintiff's reason was because there's a confidentiality agreement. But the reality is the policy reason for placing the burden on the plaintiff that the Supreme Court set forth in Ellender is the very thing that happened here. The defendant did not have access to the settlement agreement. And so the Supreme Court said, plaintiff, you have to delineate the damages. You're the one seeking damages. You have to delineate at that point what amount of that settlement is unrelated to this, not attributable to this, doesn't fall under the settlement credit. And you have one way you can do it. You have to put the settlement agreement into evidence and let the trial court evaluate the four corners of it. And if you don't, then you don't sustain your burden to delineate any of those damages, and all of them apply, all of the settlement amounts apply to the judgment and get credited.
Mr. Yanoff, at the beginning you said that the burden starts with the defendant to request a settlement credit, and you made it sound like there was agreement that that had been done, but I understood the appellee's brief to have a dispute with you as to that factor because there were no pleadings requesting a settlement credit.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that the plaintiff asserted certain procedural objections. The fact of the settlement and the amount of the settlement was submitted by stipulated evidence subject to certain procedural objections.
Well, I understand that you all entered into an agreement to enter the fact of the settlement agreement and the amount.
Yes.
But where was your request to even receive the settlement credit?
The settlement credit was requested on numerous occasions. In the stipulated evidence on settlement itself, in the reporter's record around that time period, nine reporters record 185 through 193, court exhibit 2 is the actual document. And in it, it lays out specifically that there is a settling person. It's Liberty Mutual. They entered into a settlement with plaintiff. And then on the record at 7, reporters record 8 is the first time I believe it occurs. 7 reporters record 5, this is before closing arguments, the defendant asked for the credit to be applied. Now, it doesn't need to be asked for before the verdict. It needs to be asked for before the judgment is entered, because the settlement credit doesn't apply unless there's an adverse verdict. It doesn't need to apply. But there was discussion of it there, and then after the verdict was entered, but before judgment was entered, this is over a month before judgment was entered, at 7 reporters record 1847, I'm sorry, 7 clerks record, 7 clerks record 1847, there was a post-verdict brief that was filed that specifically asked for the settlement credit, again, to be applied before judgment was entered. And then finally, on May 21st, 2012, again, this is about 3 weeks before the judgment was entered, this is at 10 clerks record 2600 through 2601, the defendant again asked for a settlement credit, and cited a number of cases, including the Ramsey versus Spray case from this court, which is a Chapter 33 settlement credit case. The defendant cited Section 33.012, the specific provision it was asking for the settlement credit under. So those are all of the instances where it was asked for before judgment. Obviously, the JNOV and the motion to modify judgment reiterated that we were again seeking the Chapter 33 settlement credit. Section 33.012 makes it clear that it is mandatory. It says if a claimant, this is subsection B, if a claimant has settled with one or more persons, the court shall further reduce the amount of damages to be recovered by the claimant with respect to a cause of action by the sum of the dollar amounts of all settlements. It is mandatory. It is not permissive. It is not discretionary. It is a mandatory provision. As the court knows, the statute has gone through numerous progressions over the years. The statute used to place conditions on being entitled to the settlement credit. It used to have, for example, a written election of settlement credit that you had to file because you had to choose between percentage of responsibility, sliding scale, or the actual dollar amount of all settlements. No more. The legislature has written that out of this version of the statute. Between 2003 and 2005, as a result of the tort reform statute, HB 4, the legislature, whether it was intentionally or not, maybe the unintended consequence was this settlement credit was tied to the percentage of responsibility found against settling persons. The legislature has written that out as well. And this is the current version that governs this case. The court shall reduce the amounts recovered, amount of damages to be recovered, by the sum of the dollar amounts of all settlements. It is a mandatory provision as long as Chapter 33 applies. That's clear here, too, because Chapter 33 applies to tort claims. It applies to negligence claims. This was negligence.
What is your response to the argument that the settling party was submitted to the jury and the jury found no responsibility?
Yeah, my response is that in the 2003 to 2005 time period, that would have been a decent argument, because the statute looked like it tied percentage of responsibility of the settling persons to the amount of the settlement credit you would receive. But the legislature wrote that out in 2005. Under the current version, you reduce it by the amount of all settlements, regardless of whether a settling person is submitted to the jury or there is responsibility placed on that settling person. You further reduce it by the amount of all settlements.
Is it clear from the record why that was submitted to the jury?
It's not clear from the record why it was submitted to the jury, but Liberty Mutual only could have been submitted to the jury as a settling person because they weren't in the case anymore as an active remaining defendant. The burden began with the defendant. The defendant had to ask for the credit, put on evidence of the settlement, and put on evidence of the settlement amount. Court Exhibit 2 makes it clear that was done. The burden then shifted to the plaintiff to dispute that evidence with the settlement agreement. It's the only way, according to Ellender, that it could have been done. The plaintiff refused to do it in this case. He did not put the settlement agreement into evidence before the trial court. And as a result, it is mandatory, it shall, 100% of this settlement credit gets applied to the judgment. The result of that is a take-nothing judgment. And every case that has addressed, that has reversed by finding an abuse of discretion and not applying the settlement credit has reversed and rendered. This court in Thaling versus Matthews, Chief Justice Livingston was on the panel of that case. The Houston First at Buccaneer Homes, the Austin Court of Appeals in Galley, they've all done the same thing. They've reversed and rendered judgment. For this court to reverse and render judgment would result in a take-nothing judgment because the settlement credit far exceeds the verdict. That's what we're asking this court to do.
Well, I have another question, if I may. Pose a hypothet. Well, maybe it's not a hypothet because I think I recall seeing some discussion of what evidence there was before the jury of what type of damages were recovered. Was it the plaintiff herself who testified that the settlement was against Liberty Mutual, was with Liberty Mutual for a claim under her homeowner's policy for the damages caused by the hailstorm? Or am I wrong?
My time's expired. My answer
yes,
briefly.
Yes, okay. Please.
Okay. The claim against Liberty Mutual and the claim against Dalworth are very similar. Liberty Mutual had hired Dalworth to come in and remediate the mold that had occurred from the hailstorm. Liberty Mutual is the homeowner's insurer. And so the damages inevitably would have overlapped. But again, we don't know what the settlement agreement says. And extrinsic evidence is not allowed by the trial court to look beyond the settlement agreement. So without the settlement agreement, the trial court had no discretion to go beyond it and look at what are the allegations against Liberty Mutual versus Dalworth. But the allegations undisputedly overlapped. They were very similar. At First Clerk's record, around 11 to 31, it sets forth the competing allegations against Dalworth versus Liberty Mutual, and many of them overlap.
What page was that?
That's first volume of the clerk's record, 11 through 31. It's on page 3 of our brief, okay. Talking about the facts. But again, the settlement agreement is all that could have been used to show that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yanoff. And if the clerk will please add 1 minute to Mr. Reynolds' time, because we did go over a little bit, then you may proceed, Mr. Reynolds.
Please the court. All in attendance, including my client and her father. I'll respond by telling you first, this is a frivolous appeal. This is what happens in a state where insurance companies, and that's what's behind this and powering it, think that they can get anything without obeying the rules. You have to plead for relief. You have to prove relief, and in this case, with all due respect to counsel, he wasn't in the trial. I was in the discovery phase, the trial phase, all phases. I know the record, and that's why I sent him a letter after he had been in the case a while and said, now that you've had a chance to learn about this, would you please dismiss this case? There's no merit to it. What I propose to do in my limited time, unless you have other questions, is go through some of these points that have been made and try to straighten things out a little. On this business about the request for settlement credit, requested numerous times. If you unravel this, there's no pleading. There was never a pleading asking for credit or offset, never. And if you'll take a look at pages 36 and 37 of our brief, you'll see that current case law, remember the apples and oranges, there was an old statute, there was a new statute. Oh, my goodness, there was an election back then. Oh, the Mobile case. I used to represent Mobile, by the way, and that's an old case. It's an old law case. But when you get right down to it, if you'll take a look, you'll see from the Austin court, the Rehab versus Cooper case, and then the Geis case from San Antonio from 2011, and one or two other cases, you've got to plead and prove it. You know, there's a limitation statute that says you can't sue a doctor for something that happened more than 2 years ago. And as the court may be aware, I've done a lot of medical malpractice defense. But you've got to plead. Rule 94 says you've got to plead the defense. It was never pled. What was pled here? There was a general pleading that was vague in the answer about maybe there's some responsible third parties, but one of our appendices is the agreed order signed by Judge Wilkinson. And remember, these people are asking you to reverse what the trial judge did, which I stipulate is wrong because she did it right. She got the right result. But she signed an order, it's an agreed order that says this is moot. There's not going to be any more about responsible third parties. Then along we came to the end of the trial, and lo and behold, and I've called this invited error because I think that's what it is, and I haven't challenged it, but I've pointed out these people asked for a submission of other parties, and they got it over objection, and guess what the jury said? It's all your fault. But there's another interesting thing about the charge and the verdict, because as all of you have apparently seen from the briefs, what Liberty Mutual did, and there is testimony, Justice Gardner, and it's a question and an answer, and it's one of our appendices. What happened previously was Liberty Mutual paid for structural damage, which is not what this case was about, and that money was used to repair the damaged house. Now, as for the relationship of this company, Dalworth, if you take a look in here, somewhere in here, we've got an appendix. It's always hard for me to keep them straight. But we have an appendix, which is the contract between Dalworth and my client. They made her sign a contract with them. They were providing services. They were supposed to take care of her possessions. This is about damage to her possessions, and the charge was submitted that way. When you get back to the appendix in our brief, which is the charge, it doesn't say was there a lot of damage from a hailstorm, was the house damaged. The judge was very careful. She knew what the case was and wasn't about. She submitted it asking what is the damage to property. At one point the defense attorney said, well, you know, you're asking for damage to an oven. We think it's a built-in. Maybe that's a structural damage. So we didn't really agree with that, but we withdrew that damage request to make it clear that apples are apples and oranges are oranges. Now, you're told the undisputed evidence says there's a settlement made, and our case law shows you that you've got to plead this defense, and then you've got to prove it. They say, well, we've got a burden to prove it, but at some point we don't have a burden anymore. Well, they never met any burden. And then they say that I held back the agreement. But if you look at our appendices and the record, it's not because there was a confidentiality agreement between Liberty Mutual and someone else. It's because the federal court, Liberty Mutual, went over and filed a separate lawsuit in federal court that did not involve Dalworth, and that's what got settled. And the federal court said this is confidential. So I gave everything to Judge Curry for an in-camera inspection. One of our appendices shows that Mr. Marsh, from the captive firm that works for Travelers, the fellow who did know the trial record, told the trial judge, well, you know, there was an in-camera inspection, and so there was by Judge Curry. And I gave him everything, and he made a determination of what I could then give to other people. And so I followed the order of the federal court. I followed the order of the state court. And nothing was held back voluntarily by the plaintiff or by plaintiff's counsel.
Did you give a copy of the settlement agreement to Judge Curry to examine in camera? Is that what you said? Was that included in what you're talking about?
I gave him everything that was pertinent, everything. The agreement from the federal court, everything. I think that goes, I, I'm, I'm not trying to go beyond the record, but I'm trying to answer you. But I gave him everything.
Okay.
I put it into a packet. It was sealed. I gave it to him.
Did that include the settlement agreement then?
Yes, it included everything related to the settlement agreement. So logically, it did. I'm trying not to go beyond what's in the record because that's what's been happening to me. One thing you've been told today as well, the trial at the trial court, there was this motion filed in this brief, and it was filed after the jury verdict, and it was filed and met with an objection. These people were so unhappy that with the jury verdict, they wanted to try the case again. Then they wanted to have findings of fact and conclusions of law, and then counsel here told the court when he got to the hearing and looked at it, they weren't entitled to that. It's not my fault that this case wasn't lawyered well by the defense lawyer, but it wouldn't have made any difference in the outcome. The testimony that was elicited on the record shows the plaintiff got her house fixed. That's structural damage. That's not what this case was about dealing with Dalworth. As for Mobile and Utz, those are cases dealing with other versions of the statute and dealing with other fact patterns. I would submit to you that what's important here is everyone has the burden to come to court and plead your case and make some proof, and that basic burden wasn't met here. That's probably why nobody has come forward on the appellant side to show you what they do have in the stipulation. And by the way, the stipulation they're talking about, they didn't try to plead and prove to the jury. They didn't try to get any findings that would have been relevant on credit or offset for the jury.
Well, that's not a jury question.
But they had no pleadings, Judge Gabriel, and you've been a trial judge. You know people can't just waltz in and say, someone bought a Mercury in San Saba, and therefore I can sue the Ford company here today.
I understand your pleading argument, but how
it's a good argument.
I understand your pleading argument, but how can you be arguing that they should have submitted something concerning credit to the jury?
What I'm trying to tell you is that they bypassed the entire process at every stage. While the jury was out, we offered a stipulation subject to certain objections, and I have complained that the objections were improperly overruled because I objected. There's no pleading for this. There's no proper proof for this. And those objections should have been, in my judgment, sustained. But even if those objections were not sustainable objections, all you have in the stipulation is that an amount of money was paid to make a settlement with the insurance company to do structural repair. And that's not what this case was about. The greed of insurance companies, and I know this is being recorded, but I also know I had a relative at San Jacinto who knew it was important to do the right thing, and the right thing is to get the record here straight. The greed of insurance companies in Texas is beyond bounds, unimaginable today. So they want to argue about this and say, we don't like the jury verdict. Someone got some money, so they should not get more, even though the money they got was not for this claim or for what was tried. The trial judge was well aware of all this. She didn't act wantonly. She did not act capriciously. She did not abuse her discretion. She sifted through the record. She gave these people hearing after hearing. She listened with patience to them. And at the end of the day, she made the appropriate rulings and signed an appropriate final judgment. It's their burden on an appeal to demonstrate error, such error as likely would lead to an improper judgment. And we've pointed that out in our brief. We also have pointed out in our brief, we filed a pleading shortly before the commencement of trial to make it clear we were not going to try anything by consent. And that's because the ground kept shifting. It was one argument. It was another argument. There was no relationship often to the pleadings. And that's what we've seen on the appeal. We've heard the best structured argument today I've seen on the appeal, but it's not what you'll find if you read either of the two briefs that have been filed. So I tell you that the way this has to be approached is to ask, how do you get something into court? You file a pleading. And then you figure out what proof do you have to present. They admit they have a burden, and they can't show you any pleading they've filed or anything in the record where they clearly made a proper request. It has to be a pleading request. They don't want to talk about Rule 94, although it's talked about in some of these cases at pages 36 and 37 of our brief, so it's important to other sister courts because it's part of the basic law of the state. You start out with a pleading. And after that, you make proof in a way that's appropriate, and you get findings that are appropriate. But it's fundamentally unfair, and I submit to you, beyond the scope of any legislation that we may be talking about here today, to say that if somebody bought an apple, that paid for an orange. And that's what we have here. We had a catastrophic storm in Colleyville, Texas, a few years ago, a hailstorm. One of the many buildings damaged was the home of this plaintiff. Liberty Mutual caused a problem, but eventually they backed away and paid for structural repair only. A different problem was caused by Dalworth. Dalworth was not a party, directly or indirectly, to any settlement made between the plaintiff and Liberty Mutual, and the record discloses that much, and I can say that and stay within the bounds of the record. So this business about there was an old case, the mobile case, and maybe, you know, there's been a change in the statute, and it's hocus pocus is what it is. It doesn't follow a clear roadmap. It's kind of like saying the way you get from Fort Worth to Dallas is to go to Eastland, and from there to Brownwood, and then to Texarkana. And now if you're good and tired, go to Dallas and see how you got there. The principles of this case are simple as pie. You have to plead it. They admit they have some burden. You have to come forward with some proof. And you have to be talking about the same thing. I respectfully submit to you it would be most fundamentally unfair and definitely not required by any statute to take from this woman, this plaintiff, the judgment the jury gave to her and the verdict that the trial court properly gave to her when there's no showing that that should be done. Now, I know the other side's going to get up and say I'm full of hot air and I'm wrong, but I sincerely believe I'm right.
What would your position be if the jury findings were, say, for example, 55% responsibility as to Dalworth and 45 as to one or more of the other named defendants in the jury question?
Well, one problem would be that these percentages shouldn't have been submitted. At that point, I probably would complain that there was no pleading predicate. But even if there had been a pleading predicate, asking about who is a responsible third party is different from asking about a creditor offset. We have one statutory scheme that deals with the kind of creditor offset they're talking about, another that deals with responsible third parties and when you can designate them and how you have to make the pleading and what you have to show in order to be entitled to submit something to the jury. I think the reason that the finding is important here is because, as a tactical ploy, defense counsel decided to ask for these findings, and lo and behold, they backfired on him and his client when the jury saw who, in their judgment on the evidence, had caused the problem. And it was not Liberty Mutual, it was Dalworth. Are there any other questions? I was here about a week ago and I had a bad cough. I was so embarrassed I sent a letter to everybody. I didn't start coughing till the end of argument. But today, although I have a little bit of an allergy, I avoided that. Thank you very much on behalf of my client in particular.
Thank you.
I would like to thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Rebuttal, Mr. Yanoff.
Thank you. I, simply put, there is no pleading requirement under Section 33.012, and for this court to find a pleading requirement would write the election requirement back into this statute, plain and simple. The court would have to write an election back into the statute, which is the very thing the legislature has taken out of the statute.
But we have statutes all over the place that don't say anything about notice or service of process. and the Texas rules of civil procedure still apply to how we try a lawsuit.
Here's the distinction, I think. This is a mandatory statute that says it shall apply, and it only applies to the judgment. It simply is presented to the trial court outside the presence of the jury. There's nothing to do with the jury, despite what is being argued, and as Justice Gabriel picked up on, this would never be presented to the jury. Texas Rule of Evidence 408 wouldn't allow it to be presented to the jury because it's evidence of a settlement used to contradict liability, so it'd be precluded from admission as evidence before the jury. More importantly, Utz versus Short expressly held it's not presented to the jury. The settlement and the amount are presented to the court outside the presence of the jury. And when you have an issue, a legal issue in a statute, and the only way it is presented is to the court as a matter of law in determining how the judgment should be entered, then those statutes do not require a pleading because it's not based on what's being presented to the jury. A good example of that is the prejudgment interest statute in this state. As numerous courts have held, the prejudgment interest statute applies as a matter of law. A plaintiff doesn't need to plead it. A defendant doesn't need to plead that it doesn't apply. It applies as a matter of law only to the judgment. And so you don't need to plead it. You just ask for it. It has to be entered as a matter of law. And so there is no pleading requirement. Another example is the statutory non-economic damage cap for health care liability claims under Section 74.301, I think it is, of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. That statutory non-economic damage cap has nothing to do with evidence presented to the jury. It caps non-economic damages. It doesn't get applied unless a verdict is entered by a jury, and then the judge, in entering the judgment, decides how to reduce that verdict to a judgment. And the statutory cap applies automatically. Now, a statute that applies differently, coming from a case out of this court, the Horizon versus Ald case, which was reversed on some other grounds, but in that instance, punitive damages do need to be pled, and a defendant does have to plead to undercut punitive damages or argue that they don't do or don't apply the cap. You have to. And the reason why is simple. Because how a plaintiff pleads a punitive damage case and how a defendant contradicts it and argues that the cap applies will impact how the case is tried to the jury. There are exemptions under 41.008C of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code for the punitive damage cap. If you argue an intentional tort, a felonious felony, or those types of conduct and can prove it in front of a jury as a plaintiff, you may get out from under the cap. And so the case law predictably says, well, you do have to plead that because that is a proof issue because the plaintiff can plead around it, the plaintiff can prove around it. The plaintiff can't plead and prove around this in front of a jury. The settlement agreement and issue are only presented to the court, and they're only presented after a verdict is entered against the defendant. We satisfied our burden. Ellender is the law of the land. It's not old law. It's the law of the land. Texarkana Court of Appeals, more recently in Goose Creek, relied on Ellender and said no extrinsic evidence is allowed. If the settlement agreement is not in evidence, then the full settlement credit applies. And let's be clear, what Judge Curry may have seen, which is nowhere in the record, but what Judge Curry may have seen is under seal. He is not the judge that decided how to apply this settlement credit. That's Judge Wilkinson. It is undisputed that the settlement credit and the settlement agreement is not in the record, and it was not put into evidence by the plaintiff. The full settlement credit applies, which should result in a reversal and a take-nothing judgment in favor of defendant. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yanoff, Mr. Reynolds. Counsel, we appreciate you being here today for your arguments. We appreciate all the briefing you've also provided this court in this matter. Your case is now submitted. You all are excused, and we will recess until we pick up our 10:30 cases.